what we Americans call obstruction of justice, to, for instance, retaliate against a court officer for taking action. So here the prosecutor has indicted Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Trump administration has responded by levying sanctions on this man and on the court. So that really sets, I mean, the prosecutor would be well within his rights to open up an investigation of Donald Trump for these sanctions, as he would, incidentally, for the 9 years that Israel tried with three successive prosecutors to blackmail, harass, and sting them to prevent them from taking these actions.
Ree Brody, we thank you very much for being with us. Veteran war crimes prosecutor, board member of Dawn, the nonprofit which has filed the communication with the ICC prosecutor over the role of U.S. officials, Biden, Blinken, and Austin, in supporting Israeli war crimes in Gaza. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Anjali Kamath, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland environmental advocates will sue Zenith Energy over its land use statement. Two nuclear energy bills in the Oregon legislature will receive public comment this week. And in national news, a new poll shows widespread support for conservation efforts on both sides of the aisle. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 25th, 2025. I'm Dave Johnson. The City of Portland and Zenith Energy gear up for a legal challenge from a dedicated coalition of local climate activist organizations. 350 PDX, Northwest Environmental Defense Center, Willamette Riverkeepers, and 18 city residents say they intend to appeal the Land Use Compatibility Statement, or LUCS, granted to Zenith Energy. The LUCS is a key land use credential that says the oil storage and transportation company complies with a state mandate. Opponents say the City of Portland wasn't transparent and failed to include the public before it issued the recent land use statement to Zenith. Mary Stites is a staff attorney at the Northwest Environmental Defense Center. Stites told the Portland Mercury, if the appeal is successful, Zenith's LUCS would be remanded back to the city, quote, ideally with further mandates to facilitate a transparent public process, end quote. Stites says advocates have questions about the enforceability and integrity of the conditional land use statement granted to Zenith by the city. She says it was developed through, quote, closed-door, off-the-record discussions. The city's conditional approval mandates that Zenith phase out all crude oil by 2027 and reduce existing storage tank capacity by 2029, among other requirements. When the City of Portland made its decision to issue Zenith's land use credential, several members of Portland City Council voiced concerns over the process. Councilors Anelita Murillo, Mitch Green, Jamie Dunphy, and Tiffany Koyama Lane wrote a resolution asking Portland Mayor Keith Wilson to investigate Zenith's potential violations of its franchise agreement with the city. The resolution asked the Portland Auditor's Office to investigate, quote, competing statements and arguments heard by council at a January work session on Zenith Energy. According to the councilors, city staff may have made false or misleading statements at the January work session, including about Zenith's expansion plans. The first reading of the Zenith Energy resolution at the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee will be heard by city councilors on Monday, March 10th. Oregon lawmakers are calling for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to be reopened after it was closed this month by the Trump administration. They say without the Bureau's oversight, Oregon consumers will be at a greater risk of scams and lending discrimination with fewer options for redress. Isabel Charlet has the story.
Seven members of Oregon's congressional delegation have signed a letter demanding protection for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to enable the federal agency to continue its work. The Department of Government Efficiency closed the Bureau earlier this month. Jagjit Nagra with Oregon Consumer Justice says the CFPB plays a key role in protecting Oregonians from deception and overcharges by banks and other financial institutions. He says this oversight is especially important to prevent predatory lending for large purchases like mortgages and student loans.
When you take away that enforcement mechanism, you're basically giving Wall Street the chance to say, oh, okay, now we can do more of whatever we want.
The CFPB was created in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, and since then, Nagra adds, the agency has returned $21 billion to consumers. Nagra says without the Bureau, Oregonians will have less protection against hidden fees and financial scams, among other things. Critics of the CFPB say the Bureau has lacked accountability and its regulations stifle financial innovation. But Nagra says the Great Recession, along with other banking savings and lending scandals, show the nation needs oversight and strong enforcement of consumer financial protection laws.
The CFPB never gets in the way of those businesses doing the right thing. The CFPB goes after businesses and other organizations that are defrauding consumers, that are cheating consumers.
The letter, signed by Oregon Democrats, charges that big financial institutions, which the CFPB was created to regulate, have prioritized dismantling it. Nagra points out that consumer protection shouldn't be a partisan issue because everyone is a consumer. He emphasizes the need for a united consumer voice. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Two of the nuclear energy bills before the Oregon legislature this session are up for public hearing this week. First, HB 2038. It would require the State Department of Energy to study nuclear energy, including nuclear waste disposal from nuclear energy. In 1980, Oregon voters approved Measure 7, which declared no nuclear plants could be permitted in the state unless and until a federally licensed nuclear waste disposal facility existed in the state. It also put forth in the law that voters had to approve of the nuclear plant. So far, 28 Oregonians submitted testimony on HB 2038, with 75% of the responses being in opposition to studying nuclear energy. A public hearing is scheduled in the Oregon House Committee on Climate, Energy, and Environment on Thursday, February 27th at 8 a.m. Also, in that hearing will be HB 2410, which would allow for a nuclear plant to be built in Umatilla County if voters approve it on the ballot. Early written testimony on this bill is more split, with a little over half opposing a measure to open the door to a nuclear power plant in Umatilla County. People can register to testify online at olis.oregonlegislature.gov. Demand for electricity is expected to keep going up at a time when utility and government agencies are trying to lean more on carbon-free sources to keep emissions in check and produce better prices for ratepayers. New research shows the best way to do it is to double down on multiple cleaner sources while prioritizing a reliable power grid. Mike Moen has more in South Dakota.
South Dakota is cited in a new report that says to avoid an energy crisis, America needs to have a shared vision of what a strong power grid looks like, and that multiple sources, namely renewables, should play a role. The nonpartisan think tank Energy Innovation credits states like South Dakota and Iowa for generating roughly 60% of all their electricity from wind farms without compromising reliability. But demand is soaring nationally, with data centers popping up and increased electricity use inside homes. The report suggests not all stakeholders are on the same page to ensure there's enough power to go around. But the group's Sarah Baldwin says there is good news.
We are not in an energy emergency. We actually have time to do this in a very pragmatic and thoughtful way and avoid some of the fear-mongering that we're seeing right now.
She says there's still too much misinformation, such as renewables not being reliable enough to keep the lights on. The authors say they've proven to be capable, but acknowledge it'll take more than wind and solar to meet future demand. However, they say policymakers shouldn't be tempted to pursue options like building new gas plants for short-term needs. They say that's more costly in the long run. Instead, these researchers say there should be incentives for management strategies that complement renewables, such as consumers adjusting their energy use during peak times. They do recognize, though, that it might be hard to motivate enough people to sign on. Meanwhile, Baldwin says policymakers need to remove barriers that make it hard to plug clean energy into the grid.
One of the biggest threats to grid reliability is speed. We have over 2 terawatts of new wind, solar, and batteries in various interconnection queues across the country waiting to connect. And that is nearly double the current capacity of our total grid.
The batteries she mentioned are storage sites for electricity generated from renewables when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. The report says that storage should be spread out among various locations as opposed to a centralized power plant. It says these approaches help the grid withstand extreme weather conditions amid heightened demand without having to lean on carbon-intensive sources that conflict with emission reduction goals. And some of the broader rhetoric about energy production might make it seem like renewables are fringe electricity sources, but Baldwin says that's not the case.
At the end of the day, we've been working towards a carbon-free grid for now over a quarter century, so this is not a new transition.
This is Mike Moen for Greater Dakota News Service.
Almost 40% of the federal contracts that unelected Trump advisor Elon Musk canceled as part of a cost-cutting effort will not save the government any money, according to data from the administration itself. The Department of Government Efficiency just published a list of 1,125 federal government contracts that it terminated in recent weeks. Data shows that 417 of them are expected to yield no savings at all. That's usually because of the value of the contracts has already been fully obligated, meaning the government has a legal requirement to spend the funds for the goods or services it purchased. And in many cases, the money has already been spent. Many were subscriptions to media services like the Associated Press and Politico. Others were for research studies that have been awarded, training that has already taken place, software that has been purchased, and interns who have already completed their service. In all, data shows that 417 contracts in question had a total value of $478 million. Dozens of other canceled contracts are expected to yield little, if any, savings. The Trump administration says it is targeting fraud, waste, and abuse in the government. The Department of Government Efficiency says the overall contract cancellations are expected to save more than $7 billion. Independent experts say that number is an overestimate. Charles Tiefer, a retired University of Baltimore law professor and expert on government contracting law, says, quote, "They're terminating so many contracts pointlessly. Obviously doesn't accomplish anything for saving money." End quote. Federal employee performance reviews face a confusing moment. Congress debates voting rights, and environmental groups fight offshore drilling. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There's definitely a fear and wondering if our work ethics are good enough to remain on staff. Many of us have responded to the email, so we have followed directions, but it's still that sense of micromanagement that is making us feel very insecure.
David, who asked not to use his real name, speaks from his VA office after responding to an email telling him to list 5 things he accomplished at his job last week or risk firing. Billionaire Elon Musk and the DOGE advisory group claims, without providing proof, that it's uncovered hundreds of billions in federal employee fraud, including paychecks issued to non-existent workers. DOGE faces legal challenges from unions, businesses, and advocacy groups. And amid an atmosphere of confusion, many agency managers appointed by President Donald Trump are advising employees not to comply, citing privacy and security concerns. In a major policy shift, the U.S. joined Russia in voting against a UN resolution condemning Moscow's war on Ukraine, breaking with European allies. Press reports suggest the Trump administration may be nearing a deal for Ukrainian rare earth minerals. FBI officials say they're alarmed by Trump appointing right-wing podcaster and former Secret Service agent Dan Bongino as deputy director, breaking tradition by selecting a political figure with no FBI experience. Meanwhile, Congress is debating the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act. SAVE would require a passport or birth certificate proving citizenship to register to vote. Supporters say it protects election integrity. But Debbie Gould with the League of Women Voters of Tennessee says it doesn't allow using a driver's license as ID, and she says it would end up discriminating against married women.
Well, if there was a woman who changed her surname when she married, they're going to have to show legal proof that the name has been changed because it doesn't match the birth certificate anymore.
The league estimates over 20 million Americans may struggle getting the necessary documents. Seven of Oregon's members of Congress have signed a letter calling for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to be reopened. Jagjit Nagra with Oregon Consumer Justice says the agency created in response to the financial crisis has returned more than $20 billion to consumers while fighting scams, predatory loans, and hidden fees.
When you take away that enforcement mechanism, you're basically giving Wall Street the chance to say, oh, okay, now we can do more of whatever we want.
The White House is confirming that tariffs on Canada and Mexico are on track to take effect next week after a month-long pause. Environmental groups are suing over the administration's plan to expand offshore drilling. Christian Wagley with Healthy Gulf says opening parts of the Gulf protected under President Joe Biden would threaten states like Florida.
The water is clean, our beaches are clean, and Florida's economy really depends on that. And that would be directly threatened by expanded oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth interview with Portland City Forester Jen Cairo on the draft urban forest plan, available now for public feedback. It's 6, it's the way out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 62. Today in history, in 1870, Hiram Rhodes Revels, a Republican from Mississippi, is sworn into the U.S. Senate, becoming the first African-American to serve in Congress. The quote of the day is from American literary critic John Leonard, who said, quote, "To be capable of embarrassment is the beginning of moral consciousness. Honor grows from qualms." The Trump administration has threatened federal funding for a lot of different programs. This week, tribal leaders headed to D.C. to testify about the programs that impact their communities. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders from across the country are providing testimony in Washington, D.C. this week on American Indian and Alaska Native programs. Three hearings are being held in the House Committee on Appropriations, Subcommittee of Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies. Tribal leaders Tuesday morning mentioned how the Trump administration's recent actions, including the federal hiring freeze and layoffs, threaten essential services in Indian country. Tribal leaders are raising concerns about federal funding for healthcare, law enforcement, education, and other services. While tribal leaders are calling on the federal government to uphold trust and treaty obligations, Chief Jay Allen of the Coeur d'Alene tribe is also urging for strong leadership.
All I'm asking is for leadership for us to come together and work this out.
Allen echoed funding needs for tribal programs, which he says have been historically underfunded, and urged the subcommittee to address tribal concerns. The hearing continues Tuesday afternoon and hearings Wednesday and Thursday. According to the subcommittee, there were an unprecedented number of requests, needing a third day to accommodate around 100 tribes and tribal organizations. The state of New Mexico announced Monday that state agencies are launching support initiatives to help people recently dismissed from their federal employment as the Trump administration seeks to shrink the federal workforce. The initiative includes recruitment events, online resources, and access to education and training opportunities. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham says the state is committed to supporting people into transitioning into new career opportunities. Online resources offer information about unemployment insurance, job search, and career support. Recruitment events will take place in the state in the next couple weeks, featuring employers ready to hire, including the state and local governments and private businesses. New Mexico's congressional delegation has been advocating for the protection of federal employees, including those serving Indian country. A new sponsorship program in Nevada is seeking to get more tribal citizens covered and protected from accumulating debt from uninsured medical care. Alex Gonzalez has more.
According to reporting from KFF Health News, while some tribes already participate in Nevada HealthLinks program, they're wanting to get more on board. The initiative allows tribes to buy health insurance through the state's Affordable Care Act marketplace. Advocates such as Jim Roberts with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium contend the sponsorship model increases access to coverage by giving Native folks a chance to search for medical care outside the tribal care system.
I think sponsorship programs bring case management to that process to allow people to understand what their options are so that they can get enrolled. Left to their own devices, this is a segment of the population that might not traditionally enroll in Medicaid or in insurance program.
Roberts adds that because sponsorship in some tribes isn't limited to just enrolled tribal members, it can impact whole communities. But he's worried that under the Trump administration, enhanced tax credits for marketplace enrollees will sunset by the end of the year if Congress doesn't extend them, meaning premiums could go up significantly. Proponents say the sponsorship program is making a difference for Native American patients, but more work is needed to build community trust. While Nevada Health Link used Washington State's program as reference, Roberts says the Silver State's approach is different.
But in terms of Nevada really getting behind it and asking the QHPs to work with tribes to set these up, I think that's unique.
Roberts wants to remind folks they won't lose their Indian Health Service coverage by participating in the sponsorship program, but will rather help fill in vital gaps in the healthcare system.
By providing resources that can then get billed for the care that they're receiving. And likewise, those resources can be used to expand care to the tribal population as a whole. Then it's a win-win situation.
I'm Alex Gonzalez reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The 2025 Conservation in the West poll shows support for conservation efforts across the West is strong with all political parties, including MAGA Republicans. This comes as the Trump administration begins rounds of layoffs in the U.S. Forest Service, National Park Service, and other federal agencies. Kathleen Shannon has more in Montana.
In its 15th annual year of polling on conservation in the West, the State of the Rockies project this year found support for conservation by some of the highest margins to date, and notably across party lines. Pollsters have always asked respondents to identify their political parties, but 2025 marks the first year respondents could affiliate with the MAGA movement. Results show that regardless of affiliation, support for conservation is strong. Catherine Hahn with New Bridge Strategy, which conducted the report, notes that 69% of MAGA supporters oppose reducing funding to federal agencies that manage public lands and wildlife.
Among MAGA supporters, 81% approve of the National Park Service, 74% approve of the U.S. Forest Service, 71% approve of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and 46% approve of the EPA.
These poll results come as these same federal agencies earlier this month began laying off their permanent employees and freezing seasonal hiring as part of an effort led by billionaire Elon Musk to cut federal spending. The Forest Service fired roughly 3,400 employees, and the Department of the Interior fired about 1,000 National Park Service employees and 800 BLM employees, including many in Montana. The Trump administration released an order to review and, as appropriate, revise designations of national monuments, a power that has been exclusive to U.S. presidents for 120 years. Lori Weigel, also with New Bridge Strategy, says Westerners across the board and 87% of Montanans support keeping national monuments.
There's really no subgroup within any of the data that is saying we ought to remove those designations.
Nearly all surveyed Democrats across eight Western states support keeping national monument designations, as do 83% of Republicans and 81% of MAGA Republicans. I'm Kathleen Shannon with Big Sky Connection.
A warming Arctic could force seabirds to new feeding grounds. Researchers are struggling to track shifting populations as ice conditions change. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the Canadian Arctic, vast expanses of tundra and sea ice are home to seabirds like common and king eiders. But as the climate warms and sea ice melts, some birds could struggle to find food in their usual places. And more shipping in the Arctic increases the risk of oil spills. So monitoring seabird colonies is critical. But Julia Bach of the Canadian Wildlife Service says remote, harsh conditions make that difficult.
A lot of these colonies are quite far away, sometimes, for example, a 6-hour boat ride.
So some areas have not been surveyed in decades. And because the Arctic is changing so fast, a lot of existing data is outdated. For example, Bach recently conducted a survey of common eiders.
And we went at a time that we expected the birds would be present because of the previous data from the 1980s and 1990s. But when we got there, the sea ice was already broken up. And so the birds, normally concentrated in a crack in the sea ice feeding, could have been anywhere.
So Bach and her colleagues are compiling existing data so researchers know which areas and species have been studied and when. She hopes this helps them prioritize which areas to study in the future and guides conservation as the climate changes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now we go to global citizen commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. He says President Trump has made clear in denigrating remarks about Ukraine's President Zelensky that the U.S. wants to end the war on Russia's terms. Future U.S. aid to Ukraine will require payments from its mineral resources as though Ukraine is the aggressor state. Ukraine may have to accept Trump's terms, though it could choose to continue fighting. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. On February 18th, Presidents Trump and Zelensky spoke by phone following U.S.-Russia talks in Saudi Arabia that aim at ending the war in Ukraine. Their conversation boils down to this. Trump offered his usual mix of lies and outrageous demands, and Zelensky politely and indirectly suggested that Trump was selling Ukraine out. I would like to have more truth with the Trump team, said Zelensky, who, rather than criticize Trump directly, excused him for being, quote, caught in a web of Russian disinformation. Zelensky rightly is accusing Trump of parroting the Russian line on the war and thus making the U.S. untrustworthy. Trump said Ukraine started the war, that it should have ended the war 3 years ago, and that he would have ended it had he been in power. All nonsense, but music to Putin's ears. Indeed, Vladimir Putin is publicly thanking the Americans for not blaming Russia and wanting to look ahead. But wait, Trump has just amended his statement, saying on Fox Radio, quote, Russia attacked, but they, meaning Biden and Zelensky, shouldn't have let him attack. Another lie to cover up the previous one. Further in line with Russian talking points, Trump criticized Zelensky's leadership directly. Think of it, a modestly successful comedian, Vladimir Zelensky, talked the United States of America into spending $350 billion to go into a war that couldn't be won, that never had to start, but a war that he, without the U.S. and Trump in capital letters, will never be able to settle. He called Zelensky a dictator without elections, who better move fast, or he's not going to have a country left. I guess Putin doesn't qualify as a dictator without elections. Keir Starmer, Britain's prime minister, had a response, quote, The prime minister expressed his support for President Zelensky as Ukraine's democratically elected leader and said that it was perfectly reasonable to suspend elections during wartime, as the United Kingdom did during World War II, a spokesperson said. But truth doesn't matter when you have near absolute power. Trump is determined to end the war, cutting costs, promoting business opportunities in Russia, drastically reducing the U.S. role in NATO, and enabling him to focus on China. Ukraine means nothing to him, whereas cozying up to white Christian nationalists like Putin means everything to Trump and his minions as they seek to redraw the map of Europe. Zelensky is bargaining from weakness. He's excluded from the U.S.-Russia talks. He knows he can't rely entirely on Europe for security, and he also knows that Ukraine will have to sacrifice territory in a settlement with Russia. Worse yet for Ukraine, Trump has made further U.S. aid conditional on Ukraine's agreement to a one-sided sell-off of its mineral and oil wealth. Trump is demanding $500 billion worth of Ukraine's resources, more than four times the $119 billion in actual U.S. aid to Ukraine. It's a disgraceful arrangement that would essentially make Ukraine a U.S. colony, as though Ukraine is the aggressor and must pay reparations. The proposed deal provides no protection from Russia, which would not have to pay a dime for what it has done to Ukraine's people and resources. And it's sign or else, says Trump, quote, we're going to either sign a deal or there's going to be a lot of problems with them. There is another completely different side to this war's next stage that is rarely discussed. One in which Ukraine rejects a U.S.-Russia deal and fights on, Ukraine would encounter mounting logistical problems over time, but it has the capability to withstand Russia's assault for another year or more. Writing in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, Natalia Gumenyuk, a Ukrainian journalist, cites strong Ukrainian support for no deal rather than a bad deal. She writes of the country's resilience this way. Despite intense pressure on civilian areas, Ukraine has managed to preserve and even rebuild a degree of normalcy in everyday life. Following the economic shock of the initial invasion by Russia, Western budgetary support, which now makes up 20% of Ukraine's GDP, has allowed the economy to grow by an average of 4.4% over the past 2 years. There has been real household income growth, and inflation remains fairly low. Maritime routes have been open again, with Ukrainian exports up 15% over the past year. And according to the government, some 40% of the weapons Ukraine is using on the front lines are now produced domestically. Despite the extraordinary hardships of war, she writes, Ukrainian society has a kind of adaptability and endurance that may not be fully visible to outsiders. I would add that as the war goes on, Russia will continue paying a high price in lives and in its economy. So let's remember this about Ukraine. It's their country. It is the victim of an aggressive war, and it has fought courageously to preserve its independence. Ukraine deserves better than to be cast aside so that Trump can serve his own narrow ambitions. I'm Mel Gertoff of the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 25th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team and tonight's newscast includes Dave Johnson, Josh Salem, and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, and Kathleen Shannon. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.org.